It's a great pleasure to welcome here to the Weekly Creek Lecture, Professor Christopher Livanos. Before I get to the formal introduction, though, I just want to mention that there's no Creek Lecture next week because of the AC's meeting, National Conference meeting. However, if you're not attending that convention in New Orleans, there is the Polish Film Festival going on in Madison next week. Jennifer has a list of the films, and I guess that's just on our website as well.
It's on the website, and we have copies of the program on the table in the back.
And in addition, there is a talk tomorrow in the Slavic department called How a Modernist Artifact is Made, Poetic Stone Women and Russia's Indigenous Cubism. So if you like more poetry, although this is just poetic stone women, I'm not sure how much poetry there is actually in the talk, but that's in the Slavic department, and there's also a flyer for that tomorrow. Okay, so today it's my great pleasure to introduce one of our faculty associates, Professor Christopher Livanos. He's an associate professor in comparative literature here at UW-Madison. His research examines Greek poetry and the history of Greece's intellectual relations with the so-called great powers, so a very nice cross-regional, boundary-crossing kind of research agenda. Professor Livanos is a member of the UW faculty since 2001 and the author of Greek Tradition and Latin Influence in the Work of George Skalerios, that came out in 2006. And he has a current project titled Utopia, Dystopia, and Labor, a study of speculative fiction in English and Russian, which sounds extremely interesting. Even more interesting, the courses he teaches in Conflit range from medieval love poetry to Conflit 203, Scary Monsters. So please welcome Professor Chris Livanos.
I'd like to thank you for the introduction. I'd like to thank Jennifer Tischler and everyone at CRECA for the opportunity to speak to you today. I would also like to thank two wonderful librarians, our Eastern Europe librarian, Andrew Spencer, and our recently retired humanities librarian, John Dillon, for their heroic efforts in obtaining for me the only circulating copies in North America of the texts I will be discussing today. And before that, let's see you get prejudiced against the text I'm going to be discussing. It's absolutely scandalous that that's the case. Although Yannis Ritsos is widely regarded as one of modern Greece's greatest poets, his translations are not included in the 13 volumes of his so-called collected poems. They're no less accomplished as works of art than, for instance, Paul Celan's translations of Blok, Mandelstam, Yesenin, and other major Russian poets into German. But while the latter are readily available in a bilingual parallel text format in the standard 5-volume edition of Celan's collected poems, Ritsos' translations remain obscure within Greece and practically impossible to find abroad. For the most part, there are some exceptions that I'll be discussing. The reason for the obscurity of Ritsos' translations has a lot to do, I'm sure, with modern Greek's status as a lesser-known language. But I find it kind of odd that it's actually easier to find translations of Yannis Ritsos in English than it is to find a decent translation of Sergei Yesenin. That's kind of strange. We'll talk about that later. I nonetheless find it surprising that Ritsos' translations are not more widely read by Greeks. If anybody present happens to work in so-called minor literatures, I'd be interested in knowing if that's the case. When a major poet who works in a minor literature does a lot of translation, do the translations across the board just kind of become less well-known than when, say, for instance, a major German poet produces very high-quality translations? I'm not sure if Ritsos' translations are not more widely circulated because of universal issues facing authors who work in lesser-known languages, or if the matter is more unique to the culture of modern Greece. Greeks just tend to have a fascination with foreign languages, and maybe that has something to do with it. Ritsos' translations of Mayakovsky, and to a lesser extent, Ehrenberg, have been promoted by the Greek Communist Party for ideological reasons. His translations of Bloch's Politically Ambiguous, the 12, and of Yesenin's, for the most part, non-political poetry are almost entirely ignored, creating a distorted image of the nature and extent of Ritsos' interest in Russian poetry. The Greek political center, which would like to separate Ritsos' poetry from his politics, could find support for their position by looking more broadly at the range of Russian poets who influenced Ritsos. But the center seems predisposed to accept the left's somewhat rigid position that Ritsos' concern with Russian culture could only have been ideologically motivated. This is a shame because the center would probably like what they found if they ever bothered to look. To round out our picture of how Ritsos figures in contemporary Greek cultural discourse, the further one looks to the right, the more one finds a demonization of Ritsos both as a writer and as a man. In a short critical essay published with his 1957 translation of Bloch's The Twelve, Ritsos states, "Bloch's poem gives us a broad portrait of the time, surprisingly impartial, so much so that the sympathy of the poet, as well as that of the critic and the reader, regarding the clash of the old world and the new, is problematic." I would like first to say something about the political significance of Ritsos' wish in 1957 to translate a poem that he acknowledges cannot fit an easy ideological agenda. Then I would like to address what I think are more important questions of what Bloch meant to Ritsos as a poet. So I'm going to be talking about these translations today in the chronological order in which they were made. Not in which the poems were written, but in which the translations appeared. So first beginning with the 1957 Greek publication of Bloch's The Twelve. In its historical context, the 1940s had been a decade of constant war in Greece. After the end of the Second World War, conflict between the Greek Communist Party, supported by Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, and Albania, and the Greek government, supported by Great Britain and the United States, led to a civil war that did not end until 1949. Historians differ in their assessment of Stalin's interest in Greece. The majority of scholars hold that he recognized Greece as falling under Britain's sphere of influence and thus did little to support the efforts of Greek communists against the Western-backed government. It would be beyond the scope of the current paper to go in depth into the many differing interpretations of the Greek Civil War, for our purposes today, I would like to discuss the importance of Yannis Ritsos within Greece before moving on. I realize a couple of you I know are very, very familiar with Ritsos as a person. During the end of the Greek Civil War in 1948, Ritsos was imprisoned for 4 years as a member of the Communist Party. He was a lifelong member of the Greek Communist Party, and he was imprisoned more than once for his political views. However, Ritsos did say that he wanted to be remembered, or that he thought of himself not as a communist poet, but as a poet. You can maybe say that he said different things at different points during his life. The centennial of his birth was marked in 2009, and that sort of made Ritsos sort of a central figure in a culture war which is taking place in Greece. Yorgos Yatromanolakis, a Greek journalist and writer, wrote an article in the widely read Greek newspaper Tovima with the title, To Whom Finally Does Ritsos Belong? This was in response to a volume on Ritsos, which had been published by the Greek Communist Party also that year, also to mark the centennial of Ritsos's birth, claiming Ritsos as their guy. Yatromanolakis said, we can't afford to let Ritsos be claimed by one narrow segment of Greek society. There's much more to Ritsos than simply the fact that he was a communist. Then, in response, Ritsos' daughter, Eri Ritsos, said it would not be possible, as I've said before, this is his daughter speaking, for a man with his goodness and kindness to be anything other than a communist, because he loved people truly and deeply, and he suffered for them. So there was sort of this back and forth. The Communist Party published a pretty widely read book commemorating Ritsos on the centennial of his birth. There was a response saying, look, there's a lot more to him than simply this. And then there's also kind of this counter-assault by the Greek Communist Party attempting to reclaim him. I think just the point that I'd like to say all of this makes is Ritsos is important within modern Greece. People argue about him. People want to claim him. Now, back to the Greek Civil War, the sort of cultural political climate leading up to the publication of his first volume of translations from Russian. I simply wish to say that this map of Kreeka, as we zoom into the Balkans, is missing something. for reasons which I understand, which I understand, there are two ways of drawing up the map between Eastern and Western Europe. It's sometimes drawn on the basis of whether or not a country had a communist government in World War II, and sometimes on the after World War II, and sometimes on the basis of whether a country was historically Eastern Orthodox or Roman Catholic. Neither system is perfect. I understand the Kreeka map is drawn the way it is for important reasons. I just want to say it would be kind of unusual to hear a Greek speak of his or her country as part of Western Europe. I just don't hear that very often. The first time I heard a Russian refer to Greece as part of the West, I was shocked. My Russian professor laughed and said that the West in Russia just means anything west of Russia, and that Russia and the West was a national obsession. Okay. A similar obsession with Greece and the West exists in Greece. I've argued in my previous work that since Byzantine times, there has been a strong current within Greek culture identifying Greece with the East. Since the time of Russia's rise as a significant political power, anti-Western Greeks have emphasized relations between Russia and the Greeks, and now I'm talking about going way back into the 16th century and before. During the Ottoman period, stories circulated of a blonde race from the north that would defeat the Ottoman Empire, liberating the Greeks and other Orthodox peoples. Without entering into discussions on whether or not Stalin attempted to build communist Moscow as a fourth Rome. That's the title of a recent work by Katerina Clark, which would be far outside the scope of this presentation. I can say that the Greek Communist Party operated within a culture that had long been accustomed to seeing Russia as a benevolent cultural and political force. the protector of Orthodox Christianity became the protector of the international proletariat. Just one thing I'd like to say about that, tying this in specifically with Yanis Ritsos, is it's really remarkable how much Christian imagery appears in his poetry for a communist poet. Most historians believe Stalin had little interest in the Greek Civil War and that most of the KKE, the Communist Party of Greece's support, came not from the Soviet Union but from Greece's Balkan neighbors. Yet propagandists, including Ritsos, portrayed Stalin's distance not as a betrayal but as proof of his benevolent desire not to rule the Greeks but to inspire them to liberate themselves. Ritsos in 1953 wrote one of the most disgustingly sycophantic poems that had been written by a Greek poet about the death of a ruler since Byzantine times, commemorating the death of Stalin, saying, "Stalin is not dead, he's alive in the lights when you turn them on, and he's alive in the trains when they come." And that poem also hasn't made it into his collected works. But that, you can say, is maybe for more obvious reasons. That one's kind of been swept under the rug. I just bring that up to say Ritsos was very much a... he was a hardliner his whole life. He has often been sort of lumped with his fellow communist poet Varnalis into what gets called a Russian school of Greek poetry. Sometimes it's spoken of, there was a Russian school with Ritsos and Varnalis, then there was a French school with Odysseas Elitis, then there was the Anglo-American school with George Seferis. That's kind of simplistic. The futurist movement, especially Mayakovsky, was the greatest influence on Ritsos' very early poems. His first volume of poems was called Tractor, published in 1930. And you can think right there, the name Tractor, he's interested in technology. It can lead to sort of facile comparisons with Mayakovsky. It's true there was an interest, but I want to say his interest in Russian literature were much broader than that. His interest in Mayakovsky never waned, but it wasn't the only influence in his life. 1953, several months after the death of Stalin, and I believe that is significant, he composed a poem entitled Yasu Vladimir Mayakovsky. Yasu is kind of the most characteristic Greek greeting. In 1964, he published an essay entitled, 1965, he published an essay entitled On Mayakovsky, and in 1964, he published his volume of translations from Mayakovsky, a selection of which from the poem At the Top of My Voice by Vyaskolas is on the first page of your handout. In his essay, the 1965 essay, he lists the fall of Stalin as an apparently lamentable occurrence alongside the Second World War, the dropping of the atomic bomb, the defeat of democratic Spain, and other events that had taken place since Mayakovsky's death. Now, before going on, I would like to look at some of Ritsos' early poetry. One of his very, very famous works is a piece called, in Greek, Epitaphios Thrinos. This means funeral lament. It was written when Ritsos had seen this picture published in the newspaper of a woman standing over the body of her son who had just been killed in a strike. This is a series of poems. It's a short collection of poetry written in rhymed couplets consisting of 15 syllable lines, which are the common meter of Greek folk poetry. This was, I think this is really significant. Now, this was the last thing in any sort of conventional rhyme or meter that Ritsos would ever publish, except for his translations. He became a free verse poet after the late 30s, and he continued to write until 1990. So I was really struck when I started studying these translations at the care with which Ritsos made Blok, Mayakovsky, Yesenin speak Greek. Some of this is here in English. I know if you're in the back, it might be a little hard to read. Wavy hair that I passed my fingers over the nights when you slept and I stayed awake by your side. Saber-shaped eyebrow, finely drawn arch around which my gaze turned without rest. Clear eyes in which shone the distances of a morning sky. How I suffered so no tear would darken them. Fragrant scented lip. How when you spoke, stones and dry trees blossomed and nightingales took wing. Listening to this, you'd think this is a woman talking to her lover, wouldn't you? But no, this is a woman lamenting over the body of her dead son. And Ritsos then engages with a Greek tradition of funeral laments that goes all the way back to Antigone's lament over her dead brother, Andromache and Hecuba's lament over Hector. And this song was famously set to music by the composer Mikis Theodorakis in 1961. I'll play some of the music here. I wanted to show you some of Ritsos' poetry that he's best known for, but I first wanted to show you some of this And I'll be turning now to Ritsos's translation of Bloch's The Twelve. I'll let Grigoris Bitikotsis finish singing, though he's almost done. Translated four volumes of poetry, also a collection of stories about animals for children by Alexei Tolstoy. I'm not going to be talking about that today. It's really fun. This is actually, you've read some of them? Yeah. This is actually the only one that is still read, widely read in print. Like Greek kids read these stories. I've actually seen them in like church bookstores and stuff because I mean they're fun, they're entertaining. So in 1957, Bloch's The Twelve, 64, volume of poems by Vladimir Mayakovsky. 66, Ehrenberg's The Tree, 1980, Sergei Yesenin's poems. If you're a student of Russian poetry, you're probably looking at these four poems and thinking, well, the obvious one, what does not belong in this picture? If you see Bloch, Mayakovsky, Ehrenberg, Yesenin, I'm gonna grill one of our complete grad students. Which one doesn't belong? Right. All right. Okay. Aside from Mayakovsky, the one Russian poet whose relation to Ritsos has attracted some recent scholarly attention is Ilya Ehrenberg, who by the 1960s was famous as a prose author and cultural figure, but almost totally obscure as a poet. Ritsos' 1961 essay on Ehrenberg makes the case, and I'm not here to comment on its accuracy, that Ehrenberg was primarily a poet. He was famous as a memoirist at this time. Very famous as a memoirist. I mean, he was a leading Russian intellectual and cultural figure, but almost completely obscure as a poet. I will later discuss why I believe Ritsos may have said this about Ehrenberg when he did. But I don't take his critical assessment at face value. Ritsos was well aware that Ehrenberg had nowhere near the poetic status of Bloch or Yesenin, two poets whom Ritsos translated with a great deal of sensitivity and skill. Yet his impact on Ritsos has attracted little scholarly attention. It is especially clear that Yesenin was important to the late Ritsos. To a far greater degree than in his translations from other poets, Ritsos inserts his own poetic voice into the Yesenin translations. Some of these are in your handout. I'll discuss those. So much so that the Yesenin enthusiast may take exception, but we must nonetheless ask ourselves why Ritsos would take such license when his normal practice as a translator was to reproduce the rhyme scheme and meter of the original with the greatest fidelity, as we see here. To begin our discussion of these translations in the order in which they were made, here is the final section of Bloch's The Twelve. This is Bloch's original Russian. This is Ritsos's translation. This is an English translation done by Maria Carlson. And I thought just since the end of the page looked kind of bare, and this poem had been translated by a poet who was one of Ritsos's contemporaries, Paul Celan, at about the same time, I just put this up here because I'm incomplete. Ceylon's translation was done in 1958. Rizzo's was done in 1957. By the time Rizzo's translation came out, Bloch's The Twelve had already been translated into all of the major European languages. Now, the Communist Party had been outlawed since the end of the Civil War in 1949. Rizzo's himself had spent 4 years in prison from 1948 to 1952. Though this was a bleak time for the Greek left, the Soviet Union seemed to be prospering and global communism seemed to be on the rise. The publication of The Twelve in such a climate then can be understood in part as a celebration of Russian culture. Acknowledgement of the poem's political ambivalence displays a confidence that the poetic achievement can be valued over doctrinal purity. At least that's how I understand the political significance of this translation appearing when it did. Now for the poetic significance. The Twelve is unique among Bloch's poetic work for its extensive use of colloquial idiom. Colloquial speech is not common in most of Bloch's poetry, but is omnipresent in The Twelve. The search for a new type of poetic language was relevant to Greek writers of Rizzo's generation, who were themselves creating the modern Greek language as they wrote. Modern Greek, in the 1950s, people like Yannis Rizzos, Odysseas Elitis, George Seferis, some other people in prose, really were creating what was going to become the normative form of the modern Greek language. The official, several of them, you know, even said that in retrospect. The official language of Greece at this time and since Greek independence from the Ottoman Empire was a language called Katharevousa, purifying Greek. Essentially, it was a mixture of modern and ancient Greek, and you needed to be educated in order to understand that. An uneducated person, for instance, could be put on trial in Greece, and this happened sometimes, and the judge could ask, are you guilty? And he'd say yes, because they had absolutely no idea what was going on. And it wasn't until much later that what's called Demotic Greek, the language that we see here, became the official language. Essentially, Katharevousa, purifying Greek, can best be described, to put it simply, as a combination of ancient and modern Greek. And probably its most notable feature is a somewhat archaic grammar and getting rid of foreign words. There are especially Turkish words, also a lot of Italian words. But no poet of any significance wrote in Katharevousa. Prose writers did, but poets did not. So I start thinking, well, why Bloch's Dvenadzit? Why this poem right now, The Twelve? Well, part of it, I think, has to do with the search for language. Some things that I'd like to point out about this translation, well, about the translation and maybe just about the poem. For one thing, I mean, as you notice, and I'm not trying to, you know, say anything about Bloch other than what I understand the scholarly consensus to be, you know, the language, it's a poet being interrupted by machine gun fire. The language is different because it's like he has trouble finishing his poem, you know, tack, tack, tack. In Greek, and this is written in January of 1918, one of the first and still widely regarded as the greatest poem of the Russian Revolution. I'd like to look at a couple of things that Rizzo's does with the translation here. It's a poem, just to read it in English, the final section introduces this hungry dog that we meet occasionally throughout as the poem proceeds. The dog is called the dog's a mongrel, Pios Kolodny, Pios Pizrodny. And then we move on to the end. Behind them follows the hungry dog, ahead of them with bloody banner, unseen within the blizzard swirl, safe from any bullet's harm, with gentle step above the storm in the scattered pearl-like snow, crowned with a wreath of roses white. Ahead of them goes Jesus Christ. And that's the ending. We're never told exactly what Jesus Christ is doing there. The poem ends in a theophany, and you can see how, you know, the dog and Christ, I mean, sometimes I've seen this poem read in a way where they're linked, sometimes they're seen as opposites. I don't know, but it's just interesting. It starts with the dog and ends with God. Bloch uses an interesting spelling of Jesus Christos. This is the spelling that was used by the Russian Old Believers. Normally, this would have been spelled with an additional letter E. So there's something marginalized about the community of people who this spelling is associated with. The way Ceylon translates this is, well, he can't do much, because in German you're, I guess, kind of stuck with Jesus Christ, and that's what you get. But I think I'm not a German scholar or anything, but he uses what I think is a kind of archaic verb in German, Geht. It's a language that appears in a lot of German liturgical hymns, so it sounds religious and it sounds old to a German speaker. Likewise, that's going on here. Rizos can't do much with it. He could have translated it back into an older type of Greek, but that would have been problematic for so many reasons, because the fact that this language is demotic and colloquial is so important. Maybe he could have thought of something, but he doesn't. Piso opinas menos skilos. See this word, skilos, the dog, so that keeps the same final word that we see in the Russian original, pios. The rhymes here are pios, dog, nominative singular, ros, genitive plural, Christos, a Greek word, obviously a loan word. So Rizos kind of has this dilemma. What's he going to do? And this isn't a terribly uncommon ending for a word in Russian, but it's not terribly common. It's a little frustrating for Rizos, because it's absolutely the most common ending for a word in the Greek language, half the words in Greek language, even my last name even, Livanos. You can't get away from it. So how do you make this sound interesting? Well, he does a pretty good job. Skilos has the same vowels, although the stress is different. Rizos cheats. He adds a word. He tells us that Christ is silent. Siopilos. It's a little disappointing, because the figure of Christ in Bloch's original is so mysterious, so hard to describe. He's not described, but I think the only way to keep this rhyme scheme working is to rhyme it with something. And it's not just a simple, cheap two-line one, because it goes back to this skilo. So, Mestefania bo aspraroda siopilos. Hybrosta o Jesus Christos. And it does build up to that sort of emotional and spiritual crescendo that I think Bloch achieves in the ending of the 12s. Now, I would like to compare the 12 to Rizzo's own most famous poem about civil war, called Romeo Sini, the beginning of which is up on the screen here. And just, I'll read a little bit of it to you. These trees are not at ease with lesser air. These stones are not at ease under the tread of strangers. These faces are not at ease except with the sun. These hearts are not at ease except with justice. This landscape is as harsh as silence. It hugs to its breast the scorching stones, clasps in its light its orphaned olive trees and vineyards, clenches its teeth. There is no water, light only. Roads vanish in light, and the shadow of the sheepfold is made of iron. Trees, rivers, and voices have turned to stone in the sun's quicklime. Roots trip on marble, dust laid in lentis shrubs, mules and rocks, all panting. There's no water, all parched. For years now, all chew a morsel of sky to choke down their bitterness. Well, these poems are very different, Romeo Sini and the 12. They're both poems of civil war, of conflict. Something interesting that I do notice going on in both, though, is we first see a reference to the punishing landscape. It's a very different landscape. The harsh, dry landscape of southern Greece and the harsh, cold landscape of Russia. And then the scene sort of narrows in on people. First we see the natural world. You know, black night, white snow, the wind. Then people are introduced, impossible to stay on your feet. And then we start getting reference to how people are suffering because of the weather. There's this environment of want. People are going without shoes. The important difference is ideology is implicit in Rizzo's language. These hearts are not at ease except with justice. Let's talk about justice up here. Their hands glued to their rifles, the rifles extensions of their hands are the extensions of their souls, their anger lies upon their lips, and anguish deep within their eyes like a salt pit. Whenever we hear ideological language in books, the 12, it's always from some alien voice, something from outside the poetic speaker. Like here, it's this placard saying, "All power to the Constituent Assembly." And Rizzo's acknowledges this ambivalence in Bloch's poetry and celebrates it. And I think part of what he's saying is Soviet culture is so great and it's so obviously going to take over that, you know, it can afford to be, we can afford to see a certain ambiguity to it. Moving on to another section of Romeo Sini, I just wanted to look at a passage where Rizzo says, "It would be hard for us to find a language less powerful, less stony than that of the cherry tree." I just wanted to point out this theme of searching for language, which is a part of the poem Romeo Sini. And Romeo Sini, by the way, is one of the words for modern Greece. You could translate the word as Greece, but it means Greece with reference to the Byzantine Empire as the second Rome, New Rome. And particularly, it means Greece, but making kind of an assertion, I would say. Now, no two Greeks will ever agree on what Romeo Sini means. That's been said. But it definitely means modern Greece with more of an Eastern type of a focus. So he's making a certain type of claim about Greek identity. Then just something else that I wanted to point out in the end of Rizzo's Romeo Sini, looking at Rizzo's and Bloch. We see down here is the ant's hut and the wasp's tower with its many battlements. On the same olive tree, the husk of last year's cicada and the voice of this year's cicada. The shadow on the masted tree that follows you from behind like a much tortured silent dog, a faithful dog. At noon, he sits by your, he sits beside your earthen sleep, sniffing at the oleanders. At night, he coils up at your feet, looking at a star. This is the ending of the final section of Romeo Sini, a poem of the occupation written during the Greek Civil War. I find it interesting, okay, we're introduced to this dog imagery. This is only an excerpt. And then near the end, we see this reference to a soldier reflecting on his experience. Tomorrow, he says, and he is certain that the longest road is the shortest road into the heart of God. So there's this reference to the divine. We don't quite get the same type of theophany that we get at the very ending of Bloch's The Twelve, but this soldier does. This soldier has found the road into the heart of God. And also, in contrast to Bloch's The Twelve, the poem doesn't end with the theophany, but it ends with a denouement. And now the hour has come when the moon kisses him below the ear with some distress. The seaweed, the flower pot, the footstool, and the stone ladder bid him good evening. And the mountains and the seas and the cities and the sky bid him good evening. And then at last, flicking his cigarette ash between the balcony railings, he may weep in his assurance. He may weep in the assurance of the trees and the stars and his brothers. So because Bloch and Yesenin are the two poets that Rizzo's translated who I think have been overlooked, there's been a fair amount of attention given to Mayakovsky and even Ehrenberg. I've talked a bit about Bloch. I'd like to conclude by asking you to look to your handout and in particular to look at some of the translations from Yesenin, beginning in what's on page 12 of the handout. I don't want to ignore Ehrenberg because Rizzo's, I think, deserves some respect. He said that he thought Ehrenberg was an underrated poet. But I just want to say, in 1961, when Rizzo's published his essay on Ehrenberg, Ehrenberg was falling into some disfavor because of his association with Stalin. In 1962, he was specifically criticized in a speech by Khrushchev as a writer who was a little closer to Stalin than Khrushchev would have liked. And I think that Rizzo's, who was at that time very highly regarded among pro-Soviet communists worldwide, might have simply just been trying to intercede a little bit on Ehrenberg's behalf. And then the volume of Ehrenberg translations came out in 1965. That was a tumultuous year in Greek history. Prime Minister George Papandreou was forced out of office, and the political turmoil only got worse until Greece was ruled by a military dictatorship, which seized power in a coup from 1967 to 1974, during which time Rizzo's was imprisoned once again. In 1971, Louis Aragon had proclaimed Rizzo's the greatest living poet in any language. He was released. The Communist Party was made legal after the dictatorship fell in 1974. Following that, in 1975, Rizzo's was awarded the Lenin Peace Prize. So he is an elder statesman of Greek literature and getting some significant recognition in world literature by 1980 when he turns to Yesenin. Now, the most recent Russian poet he had translated, although it wasn't that recent, was Ehrenberg. He translated Ehrenberg's collection, The Tree, which is remarkable in that very few of the poems in that collection are about Russia. He talks about occupied Paris. He talks about the Spanish Civil War. So perhaps Rizzo's looked to Ehrenberg as a model for how to be a writer citizen, a poet citizen, even though Ehrenberg, of course, was much more famous for works other than poems. Now, late in his life, in 1980, he died in 1990, Rizzo's translates Yesenin, a poet who's not particularly political. He wrote a few political poems. He wrote a poem about Lenin, which Rizzo's did not translate. He is a poet, for one thing, associated with his own region of Russia, Ryazan. I'm not going to say he's a local color poet, but he's a regional poet. I mean, he says what he has to say by talking about his own homeland. He writes a lot about his ancestral village. That's kind of a shift from the very, very international focus of Ehrenberg's The Tree. And there's a famous story about a dispute between Mayakovsky and Yesenin, where Yesenin called Mayakovsky an American and didn't mean it as a compliment. And Mayakovsky said, "Well, fine, because I'm international." I find it interesting that late in his life, Rizzo's develops an interest in the poems of Yesenin. I'm going to read a literal not exactly literal, but one translation by Luba Coffey, one of Yesenin's better known poems. "I'm the last poet of the village. The plank bridge is modest in its songs. I'm standing for the farewell mass of the birch trees incensing with their foliage. The candle of the waxen flesh will burn away with a golden flame, and the moon's wooden clock will wheeze my 12th hour. On the blue field's track, soon an iron guest will appear. Oats poured with the dawn will he reap with the black hollow of a hand." Okay, we can stop there. And now turn to page 15, please, of your handout. And if you happen to know Greek, page 14 has Rizzo's translation of this poem. And page 12 has the original Russian, and I just thought it would also be fun. Here is Paul Celan. I know some of you know German. I'm done with that for now. So on page 15, just compare these two translations, or if you know Russian or you know Greek, just look along and see what Rizzo's does with this. "I'm the last poet of the village, and I lug my simple songs to this soil. I worship the saint's icon stand. Like a lit candle, my body melts. On the clock of the moon, when the 12 harsh strokes sound so hoarse, I will see the Messiah, who will appear upright back there in the blue flower garden. And his hand of hard iron will harvest the hay of my songs, and my seeds, which can only germinate in the moisture, will disappear. Then my grain stalks and horses will mournfully call him who is further and further away, and their cry will spill in a screech and be doused in the howls of the air." Pretty different. And this is not Rizzo's MO. This is not how he translates. So this poem, I want to say, for one thing, it means something to him. The iron guest gets turned into the Messiah. And then we're told his hand of hard iron will harvest the hay of my sons. Well, that makes it clear what this Messiah is. It's the tractor. Technology coming into the village and changing it. Now I think back to how 50 years before this, Britsos's first poetic publication was an anthology called The Tractor, which is generally seen as being influenced by Mayakovsky and seen as influenced by futurism and showing kind of an optimistic attitude towards technology. Here there seems to be a sense that this Messiah has to be put in quotes. Why does he? I don't know why Avitsos does this. My first inclination was, what in the hell's going on? This is some obscure variant of this Yesenin poem that I've never heard of. But no, it's not. I've checked. I mean, if there is, tell me now if you happen to know. I've checked. I've asked scholars of Soviet poetry of this era, and they say, no, I've never heard of a four-stanza edition of this. No. So clearly, by doing this, Britsos is doing something unusual. He makes this poem his own, and I think this can sort of help us understand a shift that was taking place in Britsos's own work, when he started translating different sorts of poets, and in particular when you see that there's a translation that he really takes and really makes his own. And now I've included a couple of Yesenin poems that Britsos translated that talk about themes of rural decay and themes of homecoming. These are important ideas, I think, in a lot of Yesenin's poetry. And, you know, he writes several poems about going back to his ancestral village. Ritsos, as some of the final poems in your handout show, writes about decay, and he also writes about homecoming. So, like, for instance, if you turn to page 23 of the handout, I just want to look, draw your attention to this poem. These windows, these trees are still familiar with you, so you're still around. This Greek, Ostelipon, Denefies, Yapanda, could more literally be translated as, so then you didn't leave forever, you didn't go away forever. So this can be read as maybe the village missing somebody who's not there, or perhaps as somebody who's been away for a while going back to the village and seeing what's there. 12-year-old boys sneak in the gardens and snap sunflowers. Ships still carry people and goods. They blow their whistles, swallows and wild geese fly by. Seasons change, boring repetitions, prisons, soccer games, strikes. A black umbrella was left in the hallway, and you fade away into the familiar unknown. You, who asked for nothing more in life than to stay somewhere around here, smelling discreetly the tiniest flower. One thing I think that becomes clear is this you is the poet himself returning somewhere. And there's also the poem about the work table on page 22. And the final Ritsos poem that I would like to draw your attention to and we can compare this to the poem on page 16 of your handout that starts out, the street is so familiar, this humble cottage too. I think when we compare that with the poem that I just read, which was written shortly after that, I think we can see how he's interested in certain themes that come up a lot in some of Yesenin's poetry. Finally, I just want to look at this theme of decay, the destruction of village life, rural decay, which is a theme in a lot of Yesenin's poetry and which comes up in the poem Desolation on page 21 of your handout. The horses with the handsome riders are gone. The houses in the village are empty. A few old men sit on stone benches in the yard and watch the sunset. They have nothing to say. The storage jars and the moon have been empty for years. The old men have neglected their olive groves, their vineyards, and their grandchildren. Only sometimes at daybreak in their sleep, they hear the stars scratching on the wall with their nails, searching for buried treasure that nobody's found. When they wake up, they feel more tired than ever. They grasp their canes as if to support themselves or as if to strike some ancient enemy they can't see. In conclusion, I would like to say I think it's really scandalous that Kedros decided to leave the translations out of the so-called apanda, the so-called collected poems of Yannis Ritsos. And I think that scholars of modern Greek need to stop focusing just on Mayakovsky and even Ehrenberg. I mean, No disrespect, I like Ehrenberg, I really do. But, I mean, just because Ritsos published that when he did, and Ritsos was a communist poet, I think that has caused Ritsos scholars to maybe overemphasize that and to completely ignore the influence of people like Bloch and Yesenin on Ritsos' work. And I think the Ritsos that has emerged for me after studying this, and this is still very much work in progress, is really a much, much more interesting and appealing poet. I've always loved Ritsos. He's always been one of my favorites, which is why I was drawn to this, which is why I finally decided that I'd better go check out those Russian translations that I heard about, and why I was so shocked when I found how that there's only one circulating copy of each of them in North America, and why I was so grateful to our wonderful librarians for helping me find them. I'd like to thank them. And I think that's enough out of me. Thank you.